State of the United States and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated. This morning we have the privilege of welcoming Chief Judge Sue Robinson from the District of Delaware. You can stand. That's quite all right. We're delighted to have her sitting by designation with the court. It is a privilege to have the wisdom and perspective of a United States District Court judge, especially an experienced judge such as Judge Robinson. So we really are grateful to have her here. Now, on to the business of the day. In the first two cases, if counsel for the, all three parties in those two cases could approach the lectern, Mr. Yalowitz and Mr. Huffman for the... We are going to propose, unless there is a strong objection from any of the counsel, to arrange the arguments a little differently. The proposal would be to have Mr. Yalowitz go first, then Mr. Huffman, and then the government, Mr. Austin, and then rebuttal from Mr. Yalowitz and rebuttal from Mr. Huffman. No one would be deprived of any time, but this would have the effect of avoiding the risk of repetition in argument or having the government responding in one case to arguments that may or may not have been made or may be made by one of the other appellants. I think it would keep things easier for us, at least. If there's no objection, shall we proceed in that manner?
That sounds like a good way to proceed.
Okay, very well, then we'll do that. We will save, each of you has saved 3 minutes for rebuttal, and we'll keep an eye on that. And that will be okay with timekeeping. All right, it imposes probably more of a burden on the timekeeper than on anyone else, but I think Mr. Neal is very much up to the task, so I think that'll work fine. Very well, then. We'll hear argument first, then from Mr. Yalowitz, followed by Mr. Huffman in First Heights Bank, and Mr. Yalowitz, Syntex against the United States.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. There are two issues for decision, the first being which standard to apply to this appeal and this set of appeals, and the second one being once that standard is determined, the actual business of applying the standard. And I'd like to begin by talking about the reasons why I would recommend the D.C. Circuit standard, which does permit fee shifting in cases of bad faith underlying conduct at the primary level, at the sort of operative fact level. The first and the most important reason, in my judgment, is the Equal Access to Justice Act. We are here applying a statute enacted by Congress with the intent and for the purpose of deterring improper agency conduct at the operative fact level. And we know this, first of all, from the words of the statute itself passed in 1980, subsection C of 2412, which contemplates not only a judgment in cases of bad faith, but actually contemplates that the judgment would be paid not out of the general judgment fund, but would be paid by the agency itself. And the reason for that is so that the agency would be accountable to Congress and would be deterred from engaging in improprieties such as bad faith. And if indeed the Sixth Circuit standard were the correct one, and the agency and the United States could only be held liable for bad faith at the litigation phase, then subsection C would make no sense. Why would Congress say if the Department of Justice engages in bad faith, or if litigation counsel engage in bad faith, we're going to have the agency pay the costs as a deterrent? It wouldn't make any sense. In addition, in 1980, when Congress passed the Equal Access to Justice Act, the law was uniform at that time that bad faith could include pre-litigation conduct, conduct at the operative fact level. That was the Vaughn case. Vaughn had been cited with approval in a great number of Supreme Court cases, five or six Supreme Court cases. It had been applied by the regional circuits in a great number of cases, not only admiralty cases, but beyond the admiralty jurisdiction. And the trial judge here said that the Vaughn was distinguishable because it was an admiralty case. But certainly by 1980, when Congress passed the Equal Access to Justice Act, it was very well established that Vaughn would be applied outside the admiralty jurisdiction. And the court, the Supreme Court, had in three cases described Vaughn as describing an inherent federal power, not an admiralty power.
But you have to concede that Vaughn is, the facts of Vaughn are rather unusual.
I think that's true. I think that the inherent power to shift fees is reserved for extreme cases. I would submit this is an extreme case. I don't think there's much question that this is a very unusual case as well. And so,
but these are all somewhat fact-intensive, and the facts in Vaughn, the circumstances addressed in Vaughn, are quite unusual. And for that reason, it seems to me entirely appropriate to look at Vaughn not as a fundamental precept, but as a fairly narrow ruling in a narrow set of circumstances.
Well, I don't think that the facts of Vaughn can be layered onto the facts of this case in the way that one might say the case is on all fours. But I think that Vaughn establishes a principle, which is that the courts have the power to look at the underlying conduct. And here, Judge Brueggink said, I don't have that power. I can't look at the underlying conduct and make a judgment about whether the agency acted in bad faith. And I think that if we look at cases around the country that have applied the bad faith test to government action, we do see facts that are similar to this. And so Vaughn is instructive for the power of the court. And there are other cases that are instructive on the question of whether this activity constituted bad faith.
Why isn't Chambers the most instructive? I mean, here in Chambers, the Supreme Court revisited this issue and made some fairly broad pronouncements that seemed to address directly the situation at hand.
In Chambers, there is a dissent in Chambers that addresses the question before us, which is, does the court have power to look at the operative conduct? And four of the five justices then on the court said that the court does not have such power. But the majority said, we are reserving that decision. They said that in a footnote. We're not addressing this question. And in Chambers itself, the conduct involved activity that happened before the litigation as well as conduct that happened in the litigation. And so Chambers leaves open the very question that we're here confronting, and it's clear, for example, in the D.C. Circuit, the cases following Chambers have continued to apply the standard that I'm arguing for, which is that you do have the power to look at that underlying conduct.
What do you make of the three-part test that Shimon uses, or the three different forms of activity, that underlying conduct, the recalcitrance, I guess, to choose a word that I don't think they actually use, with respect to the compensation for the underlying conduct, and then litigation bad faith. They say that categories 2 and 3 are compensable, but not category 1.
That is the exact taxonomy of Shimon, and I find it, that is the taxonomy that they use.
And the Fifth Circuit seems to have embraced that as well.
The Fifth Circuit has embraced it, and there may be some other circuits, at least some panels of other circuits that have embraced it. I think there are also panels that have addressed that have embraced the D.C. Circuit test, which is a two-part test.
Mm-hmm.
They say litigation conduct and pre-litigation conduct. And I think that the taxonomy that the Sixth Circuit uses is not a useful one because of the because I think the distinction between phases 1 and 2 is not a useful distinction. And I think a hypothetical about our case might be instructive in that regard. As the members of the court who were on the panel and on the merits may recall, when we talked about the merits of this case, Judge Michel, the chief judge, asked about the agency conduct. And I said that I thought the agency conduct was in bad faith and that the court had the power to say that and hold the United States liable for that bad faith conduct. In the merits opinion, this court did not do that. The court said, we're looking at the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, and the court did not make a sort of normative judgment that anybody had engaged in deception or malice or anything like that. The court had simply said that Congress, by passing a statute and the president by signing it, snatched the fruits of the contract away from the government's counterparty. And therefore, under the Sixth Circuit taxonomy, we are within phases 1, we're in phases 2 and 3 for most of the conduct that I'm complaining about. Sentex very early on communicated to the government that the course of conduct they were engaged in was in bad faith, threatened to bring a lawsuit. The government understood that. Government agents wrote that down. And so from 1989 forward, we were in sort of phase 2 of the Sixth Circuit taxonomy.
Well, I don't want to cut you off, but you're suggesting that I think you said the Sixth Circuit test you thought was not very useful. I mean, you're suggesting that it just is rather a flabby sort of, the middle category really doesn't have much integrity other than the way you characterize it in a particular case. Is that
that's what I'm driving at, Your Honor.
Right.
That in our case, as it comes to the court, most of the conduct I'm complaining of is in phase 2. But if the court had ruled that indeed the agencies had acted in bad faith and that triggered liability, that very same conduct would have been in phase 1. And so why it's categorized in phase 1 versus phase 2, it seems to me, is almost by chance.
Well, I suppose there might be kinds of cases. I can see the problem in this case. I wonder, there might be certain kinds of cases in which phases, I think one in Shimon was bad faith in litigation, and 2 was the immediate precedent.
I think they did it in the first crime.
I think they did, right. But I can see how, for example, if you had a Federal Tort Claims Act case and you had an injury that was caused by terrible conduct, but then the administrative claim was made, which is a requirement in all FTCA cases, and in the administrative claim, one of two things would happen. Either there would be a reasonable determination that as a matter of law, there was non-liability, in which case you would say, well, that's not in bad faith. It was terrible conduct, but the administrative denial and then ultimately the legal position taken in court would be perfectly all right. That would be one category. You could also have a category in which, suppose the agency said, we're not going to allow any of these administrative claims, let them sue us, in which case you could say that pre-litigation conduct, denial of any access to a resolution pre-litigation would be in bad faith. There, it would seem that the Sixth Circuit's test actually would have some bite.
There could be circumstances in which it does. There are many circumstances in which it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Not only Your Honor's hypothetical, but you can think of Vaughn itself. You know, where the misconduct was refusing to indemnify.
Mm-hmm.
Or this case where the misconduct was refusing to abide by one's good faith and fair dealing obligations. And so I think that the cleaner taxonomy is the one that D.C. Circuit uses. I also think it's the better policy for the reasons it is a deterrent to improper conduct, and that was the intent of Congress. That's what the legislative history says. That is the reasoning that Judge Friendly used in the Gerstle case, in which he said it's a deterrent and it doesn't violate the American rule.
I guess my question, I can't stray far from that, though, is that it was Congress and the President which ultimately passed the legislation which constituted the breach. And if it seems to me that it would be difficult any time the government loses with your standard, it would be difficult if the government litigates and loses. I'm not sure where you draw the line, as you'd always be requesting attorney's fees in your scenario. So that's really two questions. One is, I don't know why the agency's conduct pre-breach has anything to do with this case. And the second, I don't know how the government can defend itself against attorney's fees claims if your standard applies, which is whenever you litigate and lose, you're basically in bad faith.
Well, let me take them in the order that Your Honor asked them. The agency conduct here gave rise to the breach. The breach itself, I agree, was the passage of legislation, votes by Congress, signing by the President. But the breach would not have taken place had it not been for the deceptive conduct at the agency level. And this was conduct in which agency employees, the very people who only a few months earlier had worked a deal with Centex and demanded and received consideration from Centex for these tax benefits, then went and said, we are going to come up with a plan to lobby Congress, get Congress to change the rule. We're going to pretend to be neutral, and we're going to, but in the real behind the scenes, we're going to write the legislation for them, lobby, and do all these things to promote it.
Congress is just not independent. It's just a pliable. I wish the judiciary had as much luck.
I'm not saying that Congress wasn't a willing partner, but I'm saying that in the context of the case, the bad faith is, one can make a judgment here about whether the agencies acted in bad faith. Did they engage in deceptive conduct? Did they have a malicious intent? Did they do things that, just like when we look in the patent cases, we have a fraud on the patent office, or we have willful infringement. These are things that, in the underlying conduct, can give rise to fee shifting. So. And I think that answers Your Honor's second question, which is, we're not talking about every case. We're talking about a very high standard here, which is a substantive standard. Bad faith requires some moral culpability, and it requires culpability with clear and convincing evidence. So I'm not arguing for a standard that is going to be applicable in every breach of contract case, or even in every breach of good faith case, but in only in those cases where the plaintiff can meet a standard of showing moral culpability. Your Honor, in responding to the questions, I went over my time.
Well, I'm going to restore your rebuttal time. Thank you. If that was what you were going to ask, your request is granted.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Let's see, Mr. Huffman, you also, I think, have reserved 3 minutes.
I have, Your Honor.
Very good.
I would like to address what we believe to have been the critical error below, which was the assuming that the Shimon-Sanchez test applies, the conclusion by the court, as a matter of law, that the conduct that we are alleging constituted the bad faith justifying fleece.
Let me just interrupt you for a second.
Sure.
I don't know whether you need to have any of your associates with you, but if you would like, then I'm sure Mr. Yelowitz would be happy to.
I think that's all right.
All right, very well.
I can find Mr. Horowitz.
All right, very well. And, you should feel free to do so. Right. Seat shifting, not fee shifting. Right.
Yes.
Yeah, let me just announce, just for purposes of our recording, that this is number 06-5108, First Heights Bank against the United States. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Very well. Go ahead.
May it please the court.
No, it's quite all right. We're in train.
The conclusion by the trial court that the conduct that we are alleging is the bad faith justifying fee shifting is the same conduct that was alleged or found to be the breach of the implied covenant. And I think that that was an error, and it's very important, picking up on what Mr. Yalowitz said, that what we are arguing is bad faith here is a very discrete set of facts, which are misrepresentations, misleading statements, and incomplete and inaccurate statements made by two agencies, and the contractor to one of those agencies, Mr. Susswine, in his report in 1990, which was incorporated in the RTC's report to Congress. And that, we assert, is the bad faith. That also violated statutory obligations. The government, in its brief on pages 8 and 34, twice says that the government agencies have a statutory obligation to respond to Congress's request for information with full and accurate information. And they assert on page 8 that that is what the agencies did here, and that because that's what they did here, they say, they cannot be found to be in bad faith. I would agree with them that if the agencies, the people in 1990 and 1991, the Treasury and the RTC, had made full and accurate statements to Congress, that there would be no basis for bad faith. There would still be a basis for a breach of the implied covenant, perhaps, because a breach of the implied covenant, as explained by this court in Sentex, does not require deceptive behavior or malice or any of the other kinds of things that Mr. Yalowitz has referred to.
Well, I suppose, to carry that point to its logical conclusion, or what I think is its logical conclusion, that even if the Guarini Amendment had been passed over the cries of anguish and shouts of despair by the agencies that their contractual obligations were being undermined, the case as it came to us, not this case, but the original case on the merits, would be exactly the same.
Yes, it would. In fact, there wouldn't even have to be cries of anguish, I don't think. I think the agency people could have submitted a report that said the truth, which is there is this deduction.
Mm-hmm.
It was the basis of the transaction. We all knew that. However, the benefits of that are very expensive, and either things have changed fiscally or Congress, you need to help us. You need to get rid of the deduction. That may have breached the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, either on the part of the agencies, who were the contracting parties, or Congress, if it enacted the legislation, because it's the United States. But that wouldn't be bad faith. It would be honest. But the agencies, for whatever reasons, and it's not too hard to fathom, I think, felt that they couldn't say that, because it might not work. I mean, after all, they'd be telling Congress, yeah, we made a deal, but we need you to break it. So what did they do? They said, there is no deduction. You need to clarify that. That will avoid litigation. The Treasury said, there's no deduction, we're prepared to litigate this. At the same time, the same Treasury official is telling his superior in private, if we litigate this, we'll lose. In tax court, I mean, on the tax side. If we litigate the existence...
I guess it was a little more qualified than that, right? Something like a substantial risk of tax liability
success.
I guess that's sort of code language for we lose.
I think so.
All right.
And the RTC report, of course, the degree of deception, the degree of insincerity is much greater on the RTC side, I will concede. There's no indication that Mr. Gratz, Professor Gratz, who is the author of that report and the author of the memo to his superior, was personally involved prior to that in saying exactly the opposite thing to Congress, to his agency, to others. But I don't think the trial court was under any illusions about the lack of sincerity and the misrepresentations. Indeed, the trial court found in the Sentex opinion, which is the basis on fee shifting, which is the basis for ours, that the parties were aware of the fact of the state of the law when they entered into the contract. And Mr. Susswine was a very critical part of that understanding. And then 2 years later comes the statement, there is no deduction, and Congress needs to clarify. Because to say the truth, there is a deduction and Congress needs to terminate it retroactively for these deals, even though we used it to get these deals, would have been politically difficult. But I do think it's important to understand that that is different than the conduct which the trial court itself found was the basis for its determination that the implied covenant had been breached by the Greeney legislation, or even the allegation against the agencies. That was what the court found termed bait and switch. It was the behavior of using a fruit or a form of consideration to entice someone into entering into a deal with you, and then you turn on them and you lobby Congress to appropriate the fruit of that contract for the United States. That was the breach of the implied covenant. There is a long history in the implied covenant of appropriating the fruits of the contract for oneself. That has nothing to do with being deceptive in reports to Congress. It's a totally different issue. Now, Judge Robinson, I think, rightly raised the issue, well, but if Congress is the one who breached the contract, what difference does it make if the agency's made misleading, inaccurate, untrue statements to Congress? Well, I think it makes a difference because there is quite a bit of evidence in the record that Congress was reacting to what the RTC and the Treasury were asking for. So I don't think one can just simply discount the contributing nature of the agency conduct to the ultimate breach. But more importantly, under the D.C. test, and probably even under the Sixth Circuit test if they had faced anything like these facts, which are unusual, the failure of the agency officials to abide by that kind of a statutory obligation to be full and open with Congress, we believe warrants at least the trial court re-examining that and seeing whether that bad faith was close enough a contributing factor to justify fee splitting, which he never did. He found, as Mr. Yalowitz said, that he didn't have the authority to look at that conduct. And our principal argument is, even if he was right and that Shimon is the appropriate standard, which we don't believe it is, he still should have seen that that conduct we were asserting was not the underlying conduct that gave rise to the allegations and finding of the breach of the implied covenant, but was a different conduct that had played a role and was part of the reason we were forced into litigation. I think the ultimate question would be, would Congress, would we have had to litigate this case if the agencies had been honest. I don't know that that could ever be answered for sure, but I don't think you would necessarily want that question to go unexamined when it involves such behavior on the part of the agencies. To simply say, because there's a question, we won't consider the fee shifting.
Let me ask you a question that bothers me about the breadth of the D.C. Circuit's test, as I understand it. Suppose you have underlying conduct by an agency that is, all would agree, is outlandish conduct, but as to which the agency lawyers and then ultimately the Department of Justice, whether in pre-lawsuit or in the lawsuit, take the position that there's qualified immunity with respect to that conduct. And that's a perfectly plausible defense. They maintain that defense through an expensive litigation that goes all the way up to the Supreme Court, at which point the Supreme Court holds for the first time that qualified immunity does not apply, and therefore the plaintiff wins. Fee shifting in that case?
Probably not, because under the D.C. Circuit, it's a plain statute. If I recall it, it's a refusal to conform or perform a plain statutory duty.
But the statutory duty, in the initial statutory duty of the agency, was clearly breached. That is to say, the duty of the agency not to intentionally seek to harm the plaintiff. That's the substantive conduct from which the lawsuit flows.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after that, the Department of Justice looks at it and says, the agency, you guys really acted badly, but you know what? We have a qualified immunity defense, which is perfectly plausible. We have to run with it. We represent the taxpayers. We don't give away money where there isn't a legal obligation to do so. And so everything that's done after the initial outlandish conduct, breach of the agency's duty to the plaintiff, is done in perfect good faith, even though it ultimately is unsuccessful. In that setting, do you shift fees under the D.C. Circuit's test and your test here? And if not, what's the difference between that case and this case?
Okay, on the first issue,
right.
I don't want to try and split hairs about what the D.C. Circuit meant when it said obligation, as
right.
to whether that encompassed defenses. I don't know how the D.C.
Well,
Circuit...
Well, this all may turn on split
right.
hairs, so if hairs need to be split away.
That
example troubles me with respect to how far we would be going if we adopt the D.C. Circuit's test. So
all right, well, let me... I don't know how the D.C. Circuit would address that situation, which, of course, was not before them in the hospital case. And I don't know really the best way that would be addressed, because the Justice Department really there is saying, I guess I'm lost as to somebody had a clear obligation but not the defendant?
No, the defendant, as in the agency, does something which is clearly a violation of legal duties owed to the plaintiff, but it is because of, in my example, qualified immunity, not actionable. It's terrible, but it's not actionable.
I don't think that the you could say then that the agency's, and I may be mixing the tests, the agency's failure to do that precipitated the lawsuit or made the lawsuit inevitable if there was a serious question about
mm-hmm.
whether it was actionable.
Mm-hmm.
For example, maybe if you took it to the foreign affairs area, maybe, or something egregious is done, if it were done here,
yeah.
maybe to a U.S. citizen it would be egregious. If it's done somewhere else, there are all kinds of questions about whether it's actionable. But let me bring it to the facts of this case,
sure.
because I don't think here there's any, unless Your Honor is suggesting that because the agencies were submitting reports to Congress, there might be a similarity in terms of immunity.
No. I was simply trying to tease out, maybe the hypothetical has long since lost its utility, but I'm just trying to tease out the distinction between the underlying conduct and then everything after the underlying conduct is reasonable, and as all of
yes,
us would
well,
agree,
here
is reasonable.
I think Mr. Yalitz made a very good point, and it is applicable in our case too, which is, you know, the chronology in this case was that the deals were done in late 1988. And in 1989, with FIREA, Congress took a brief look at these deals and decided, as the chairman put it of the committee, a deal's a deal. And we're not going to, although they ended the tax benefits for deals going forward, they did not touch the past deals, that, which they understood had been negotiated on the basis of these of this deduction. There then proceeded a series of agency reports and interaction between the people involved in the deal and others, including Mr. Yowitz's client and my client, in which we made it clear that we felt that we were entitled to access to this deduction, that that was the whole point of the deal, and that it would be a breach of contract, unfair and everything else, to take it away, the deal having been done, and we having given our consideration and taken over these assets. The actions of the agency, the reports to Congress, were all taken with that claim, if you will, in mind. It wasn't a formal claim, because it would have been difficult to assert one.
Right.
But it was into the arguably into the second category under Shimon and Sanchez. So I do think that if you're the underlying conduct, obviously if Guarini is chosen as the end of the underlying conduct, 1993, then this falls in the same time period as the underlying conduct.
Mm-hmm.
But I would argue that the misleading reports to Congress were not the basis for the claim of the implied the breach of the implied covenant, and therefore were not part of the underlying conduct.
Okay.
No, I didn't.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. We will restore your 3 minutes as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Austin, now you have, we'll combine your time in number 5105 and number 5108, if you need it.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The trial court's judgment denying Centex's claim for attorney fees should be affirmed. The trial court did not abuse its discretion because it did not rely upon an erroneous view of the law or a clearly erroneous assessment of the evidence. The trial court correctly concluded that both Centex and First Heights were not entitled to recover attorney fees for alleged bad faith conduct that occurred prior to litigation and that formed the underlying substantive basis for their claims of breach of contract, awarding Centex and First Heights attorney fees based upon bad faith conduct that occurred prior to litigation and that underlie their substantive claims of breach of contract are inconsistent with the purposes of the bad faith exception to the American rule.
Does the government embrace the Shimon test?
Yes, we do, Your Honor. We embrace a test which basically says that you look to the purposes of the bad faith exception to the American rule. The American rule is that you want to allow access to the courts, and the bad faith exception to that is when you want to vindicate judicial authority. You do not vindicate additional authority when you base a bad faith award on underlying pre-litigation conduct that was the substantive claim. What you are doing is punishing the original wrong.
What then do you make of the second category of Shimon? I think I understand the first and the third. I am struggling to understand the exact parameters of the second.
Well, I share Your Honor's struggle in that.
But you endorse the three-part test?
Not so much the three-part test, but basically what we believe to be the underlying view of Shimon, of Sanchez, which is that you do not look at pre-litigation conduct because you're punishing, if you do, you're punishing the underlying wrong.
But both, under both tests, under both Sanchez and Shimon, we are told there are certain circumstances in which you do look at pre-litigation conduct. And what I'm trying to see is the extent to which the government endorses that exception to the no looking at pre-litigation conduct part of the doctrine.
I understand that, Your Honor. We do have the same confusion the court does. I think what the trial court did here was try to resolve a problem that you see throughout some of the cases. You see it in Vaughan, you see it in Chambers, certainly. You see it in Hall v. Cole, and you see it in Sanchez. And what that is the nomenclature. There's a footnote in the Second Circuit decision in Karen which really goes into this. But the problem, I think there's agreement that you do not look at pre-litigation conduct and that you do look at post-litigation conduct. The problem is, where do you draw that line? And that's what the trial court was struggling with here. So what the trial court says here, if there's a formal presentation of a claim and there's the reaction to that, well, that's the type of pre-litigation conduct you can look at as long as you consider it pre-litigation conduct. Arguably, that's post-litigation conduct because you're looking at it. And I think that's the part of the Shimmy test that the trial court is also struggling with. Is that really pre-litigation conduct? Or is that post-litigation conduct?
Well, that's Schumann has a description of Vaughan.
Yes.
In which Schumann purports to distinguish Vaughan.
That's right.
On the ground, in part at least, that this was really not so much the primary conduct, so much as it was the denial of relief which was sought in a non-judicial proceeding, i.e., this person asked for relief and was denied it.
That's right.
Do you endorse that distinction of Vaughan?
We do to some extent. We think there's a better distinction of Vaughan.
That it's just an admiralty case and that's the end of it.
Well, it's more than an admiralty case because it deals specifically with attorney fees being awarded not so much as punitive damages but as compensatory damages. And that's the distinction that the Supreme Court mentioned in the Fleischmann Distilling case and that the Tenth Circuit mentioned in the Troweridge case. And I would also point to Your Honor's question concerning Chambers. We believe that Chambers, although it doesn't specifically go into Vaughan, really constitutes a complete rejection of Vaughan. Because what happened in the Chambers case is the four judges who dissented clearly and explicitly said, we believe that the Supreme Court erred because the district court based its decision upon pre-litigation conduct. That can't be done. You're not allowed to base a decision for bad faith fees on pre-litigation conduct. So clearly, the four dissenters are clearly under the view that you can't look at it at all. The majority, if it was embracing Vaughan or thought Vaughan had any validity, would have said, well, it doesn't matter. It could be pre-litigation conduct. It could be post-litigation conduct. But that is not what the majority in the Chambers case did. What the majority in the Chambers case did is simply say, no dissent, you are wrong. And you were wrong because we did not endorse pre-litigation conduct. They explicitly state what the breach here is post-litigation conduct. It's the conduct during the litigation is what we're punishing. Now, Mr. Yalowitz is correct when he says that there's a footnote in the Chambers case in which the court said, we're not directly addressing the question of whether you can consider the underlying breach of conduct. But that is, in my view anyway, and is simply a statement by the court that that would be dictum. Because we don't need to reach that question. All we need to do is reach the question that we don't believe this is pre-litigation conduct. And this goes back to our earlier.
So Chambers leaves the question open, hence doesn't tell us anything other than what 4/9 of the Supreme Court would have done with this case.
I actually think Chambers goes further than that, Your Honor, because I think if you look at the
But the footnote really does say, does it not, that we're not deciding the question of the extent to which or the possibility of considering pre-litigation conduct.
It certainly does that, but my view is it's only because the court didn't need to reach the question. I think if you look elsewhere, in fact, one circuit court, I think again it's the Troweridge case in the Tenth Circuit, specifically looked at language in Chambers and said if you look at the language in Chambers, you can't base it on the underlying breach, but you base it on the conduct during litigation and embraced that language and said, even though that footnote was there, it certainly appears to us as if the court in Chambers is saying you can't look at pre-litigation conduct. And
you should finish your thought, and then I do have a question.
And I think that the court simply didn't have to reach the question, but didn't. But what is clear from that is that's a rejection of Vaughan.
Because if Vaughan was the law, as the plaintiffs contend it is, the Supreme Court could have easily said, look, in Vaughan we said you could look at pre-litigation conduct. So the dissent is wrong in saying that you can't look at pre-litigation. You can. We don't think this is pre-litigation conduct, but it really doesn't matter because either way it's bad faith. So we think that this circuit, in the Amstead Industries case, quotes the language of Chambers in which the court focuses upon defrauding the temples of justice or defying the temples of justice. There's a clear focus upon the true purpose of the bad faith exception, and that is to look at the litigation process. Are you abusing the litigation process? I'm sorry, Your Honor.
In reading all of the circuit's decisions on this issue, it occurred to me that most of the circuits have simply held that you can't base fee shifting solely on pre-litigation conduct. It occurs to me from hearing the description of the conduct that is deemed to be bad faith, that it is solely pre-litigation. In fact, it's kind of before even the conduct that led to the underlying claim, because the underlying claim is based on Congress's breach in passing the legislation. Is it, if in fact the standard is it can't be solely pre-litigation, but you can look at it, but it can't be solely, then is that a way to respond to the arguments, or are we talking about other litigation? That's a confusion I have and a question I should have asked appellant's counsel.
Well, the solely language is confusion because, and I think I'd like to direct Your Honor to the language in Hall v. Cole, which was often the Supreme Court case from 1973, which has often been cited as a basis for that you can perhaps consider this. And the Hall v. Cole language is completely taken out of context. What the court said in Hall v. Cole is, bad faith may be found not only in the action that led to the lawsuit, but also in the conduct of the litigation. Well, the Shimon case does a very thorough analysis of the Hall v. Cole case and makes it very clear that the Hall v. Cole case isn't even a good faith or bad faith case. It's simply the common fund exception, another exception to the American rule. And what it said, and what happened there is the defendant came in and said, look, the common benefit exceptions based upon equitable considerations, and the equitable considerations here are that we engaged in good faith throughout. And the court said, no, that's not true. You engaged in good faith, you engaged in bad faith, not only in the action that led to the lawsuit, but also in the conduct of the litigation. So it was merely commenting on the conduct that occurred in that case and its relevance to the common fund exception.
So are you saying that the right standard is you do not look at pre-litigation conduct at all?
Well,
I
think that's right. I think the trial court hit it very close here. And the trial court basically here looked at the cases and came to the conclusion that you really apply a two-prong test. We're not that comfortable with the first prong because we do believe it's a little bit difficult to apply. But the first prong basically that the trial court said was, let's look at whether it's pre-litigation conduct in response to a claim that was made, a formal claim that was made. And that was based, of course, on the Shimon case and more so the Sanchez case in the Fifth Circuit. And the court said, well, here there was no formal claim, pre-litigation claim made, so that's the end of the inquiry. And the plaintiffs came back and said, well, that's not fair. It shouldn't make any difference because we basically made a formal claim in the underlying conduct because we said, if Congress, if you take this action, we're going to claim breach. And the trial court said, well, you've just stepped upon the concerns of Justice Scalia in his dissent in Chambers. Because what Justice Scalia said is you have to have these formal lines. Other, all you're doing is having substantive fee shifting. You're simply creating a statute which says one of the remedies for breach of contract is you get attorney fees if you engage in bad faith. Well, there's no such provision that says that. And also, I want to go back to the Hall v. Cole point. In the Roadway Express case, which is the 1980 Supreme Court decision, the Supreme Court quoted this language from Hall, and this is discussed by the Ninth Circuit in the Association of Flight Attendants case. And the Roadway Express Court, very interestingly, construed this language from Hall v. Cole, where it says bad faith may be found not only in the action that led to the lawsuit, not to be referring to the underlying action but instead to be referring specifically to the decision to bring a lawsuit or the decision to maintain a defense, which is without merit. So it's not even clear that the Hall v. Cole case, at least as both those courts construed it, Roadway Express, the Supreme Court case, and the Ninth Circuit are saying that has nothing to do at all with underlying conduct. So there's a lot of confusion about this. And I think that the problem is, and I think Your Honor hit on it too in your questions, is that you have to look at the underlying conduct on occasion in evaluating whether or not the post-litigation conduct was meritorious. Because how do you say, Your Honor, you know, drafted, and Your Honor was part of the extensive decision in Sentex, how do you look at the government's post-litigation conduct and say it was without merit unless you look at the complexities of what happened below? You necessarily have to look into those facts a little bit in order to understand whether the defense was meritorious. And there could very well be instances where the conduct was simply outrageous below. And yet it was defended in good faith because he had a statute of limitations defense, or it fails to state a claim, or numerous defenses.
Let me ask a follow-up question to Judge Robinson's question, because given that there is an apparent, if not a square conflict among the circuits, there's at least strong tension among the various circuit courts on this. This is a case that could potentially find its way to the Supreme Court either way. So we have to be very careful that we understand the full parameters of these tests. So I really want to make sure I understand exactly what the government's position is with respect to that second category here, because the argument is being made by your adversaries that Shimon allows recovery even if a broad application of the fee-shifting doctrine is not applicable. I inflicted my hypothetical on Mr. Huffman, so in fairness I'll inflict it on you. Does the government say, with respect to the Federal Tort Claims Act hypothetical, you recall that one, that the agency says, let's suppose, at the administrative claim level, the agency, the Postal Service in this case, says, we're not going to accept any of these claims. These people can just sue us, and a certain number of them will just give up, so to heck with them. And the agency has, let's assume it, is bad faith, failure entertain these claims at the administrative stage, at which point the person has to file suit. The person files suit, and then the Department of Justice conducts the defense in perfect good faith and loses. Fees or no fees in that case? What's the department's position?
Make sure I understand the hypothetical. So you're basically saying the administrative claim analysis was in bad faith?
Yes.
Okay.
But not the litigation. Once the case made it to court, then the litigation was in complete good faith. Everything that was done from the complaint on was in good faith, but it's demonstrable and stipulated that it was bad faith at the administrative claim level.
Well, Your Honor has hit right upon the small problem that we have with the trial court's decision. In other words, under the trial court's decision, that could be considered under the first prong because it...
Well, it's a small problem for you, but it's a larger problem for me.
Well, I would say
so
in that
I
case,
really
our
am
position
curious
would
what
be,
the government's position is with respect to
I understand that. Our position would be that there'd be no bad faith in that case.
No. So you're really asking us, if I understand it, to take not Shimon, not American Hospital, but a third position in which we would be out there alone, I think. I don't know of any other court that has gone beyond Shimon and said, under no circumstances, even if you have engaged in conduct that forces the person to go to court to vindicate their claims, that there is no right to fees. Is that your position?
That's true. But I would disagree with Your Honor that you'd be out there alone. And let me just give Your Honor some quotes, for example. Kelly v. Golden from the Eighth Circuit. The power to award fees, they're talking about the bad faith exception, is exercisable only with respect to conduct occurring during the litigation, not conduct that gave rise to the cause of action. Association of Flight Attendants.
But that doesn't, as I understand it, that doesn't walk away from Category 2 of Shimon.
I think that's true, Your Honor.
So you're asking us...
where it's the cause of action. I think the question Your Honor is asking is where it has nothing to do with the underlying cause of action,
right.
But the bad faith is only there, and I think that really is a gray area. We would agree with that.
But want us to paint that gray area black.
We believe that that's what the dissent was getting at in the Chambers case.
Okay.
That's right. And let me explain why. And I think Judge Brueging, in his decision below, really hits upon this. We're just taking it a step further than he does. Judge Brueging made clear in this case that, and which this is, by the way, what the Shimon Court was focusing upon, when you look at the substantive claim aspect, Judge Brueging's second prong, as long as the claim is part of that underlying substantive claim, that's the end of the inquiry. You're asking the gray area where it's not part of the substantive claim. And what Judge Brueging said is, if you look at the plaintiff's claim here, they're saying it doesn't matter whether or not there was a formal claim. And what Judge Brueging says, you have to have some type of fine, clear line. There has to be a formal claim, because otherwise you have now gone so far as to eliminate the American rule. You have gone so far as to run into substantive fee shifting, which is exactly what the dissent was in the Chambers case. And our position differs from Judge Brueging only in that we feel you go into that area of substantive fee shifting even without the formal litigation claim, the pre-litigation claim. Once you go beyond anything pre-litigation, you have now ventured into substantive fee shifting. And I want to get back to Mr. Yalowitz's original comment about EJIA. EJIA, we believe, not only does not lend support to the plaintiffs, it lends support to us. And EJIA, of course, I'm sure the court is familiar with the difference between Section 2412D and Section 2412B. Section 2412D says that if you're under a certain net worth level, then you are entitled to attorney fees if you prevail and the government's position was not substantially justified. And Centex, in their brief, makes much of the legislative history from 1985, where it is, and we agree with them on this, pretty clear that for purposes of Section 2412D, you look at the underlying conduct as part of the analysis of whether the government was substantially justified. It explicitly says in the same legislative history that they're talking about in the House report that you cannot consider that legislative history for purposes of Section 2412B.
But how about C2?
C2,
I take it, applies both to B and to D.
Well, in fact, I think it even more so applies specifically to B. I think C cross-references to B.
Right.
But the plaintiffs are completely wrong there. They're only right.
I guess that's right. It specifically on B.
Cross-references to it.
But right.
The plaintiffs are completely wrong there, Your Honor, because, first of all, it is 1980. That part they're right on. What they're wrong about is that Section C has nothing to do with pre-litigation conduct. All Section C talks about is if the agency who engages in the bad faith conduct, that agency is the one who is supposed to pay the fees.
Right, but typically, not universally, but typically it's the Department of Justice that takes over a case at the point at which the action is filed.
Well, Your Honor hit on the first problem with their argument. The first problem is that it's not always the Department of Justice. There are many agencies, and I believe the Centex in their brief cites cases where the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation was hit with fees for their litigation conduct. So the assumption that it only has to do with the Department of Justice is completely wrong. Yes, we litigate for the government a lot, and certainly this court sees us all the time, but there are plenty of cases going on with other agencies, so that the inference that it can only be the Department of Justice is wrong. The second leap of logic in that argument is that, well, if there is bad faith by the Department of Justice, we're an agency. We're going to get hit with the fees. So to make any connection between C2 that they're somehow talking about pre-litigation conduct is just a completely unwarranted leap of logic. It has nothing to do with it. The only reference in the statute in the legislative history of EJIA is in the 1985 amendments, which had strictly to do with subsection D, which had strictly to do with the government, and the Congress made the decision there that they wanted to do basically some substantive fee shifting by looking at it. It's not true for the bad faith exception. If Congress wanted to do that, Congress could very easily have said, you know what we're saying about pre-litigation conduct being proper consideration? Well, let's make it applicable to 2412B. They said exactly the opposite. They didn't want it to be intended to Section B. That's why we think the aegis legislative history, the aegis statute supports us. Not only does it help them, but actually supports our interpretation. The other point I'd like to address also is the concept here that First Tight's argument brought up, that there is a difference between the breach here, which I agree with them. The breach here was Congress. The breach was not with the agency's conduct. First of all, there's an important distinction to be made. Number one is that the allegations below were both, by both of these plaintiffs, the allegations were there was a breach by Congress in enacting the Greenlee legislation, and there was a breach by the agencies, whether it be the Department of Treasury or whether it be the RTC, in the conduct that they engaged in. So the fact that the court only found one when the two were intrinsically together, and as the court explained, it simply didn't reach the second question because there were other defenses that would have had to reach and didn't need to because of Congress's action. But to say that they're separate and somehow not linked is just wrong. It was part of their substantive claims, maybe not the breach found by the court, but they were both breaches. The other connection which Mr. Huffman ignores is that there's two other things that he ignores. First of all, the duty under the standard that the plaintiffs embrace is the D.C. Circuit standard. And we agree that under the D.C. Circuit standard, you can look at litigation conduct. We think it's wrong, and we think it, in fact, the American Hospital case itself doesn't even deal with pre-litigation conduct. It's strictly a post-litigation conduct case. But regardless of that, the dictum clearly says you can look at pre-litigation conduct for purposes of bad faith. But the standard that they apply there wouldn't get the plaintiffs home here anyway based upon their allegations. The standard in American Hospital is that bad faith and conduct giving rise to a lawsuit may be found where a party confronted with a clear statutory or judicially imposed duty towards another is so recalcitrant in performing that duty that the injured party is forced to undertake otherwise unnecessary litigation to vindicate plain legal rights. There's two important points there. Sentex alleges that the obligation that was breached here was a contractual duty. And they're right, it was a contractual duty that would form the breach here. Well, the American Hospital standard says it has to be a statutory or judicially imposed duty. So even under the American Hospital standard, these allegations wouldn't qualify. Now, First Tights comes back and says, oh, well, there is a statutory imposed duty because the government says that the agencies had a duty to respond to Congress when Congress asked for information. Well, that's true, but it's not a duty to Sentex and it's not a duty to First Tights. It's a duty to Congress, and it can't be based upon a duty to Congress. It has to be a duty to them. There was no duty to them. Also, the standard was misstated, although we do believe that the agencies have a duty to comply to their best ability. The full and complete is like saying somebody has to get 100 on a test. I mean, you know, you can always say they could have said something else, or, you know, that's not the standard. It has to be a good faith effort, and it was a good faith effort. You know,
you're into an area now, it seems to me, in which Judge Brueging's decision does not rest, if I read it correctly.
You are.
So, since he didn't reach any of these questions, were we to find it necessary to get to these issues, we couldn't decide the case on our own, could we, without sending it back to Judge Brueging?
I think these are
finding-based kinds of considerations, it seems to me.
Well, I think the court could reach the question that these allegations wouldn't even go to the American Hospital standard. I think that would be true. I think that it's clear that the allegations are based upon under the standard in that case wouldn't be met. I think this court could reach that question. The other thing I'd like to point out in this connection is that, and I think Your Honor raised a question to plaintiff's counsel in this regard, is there has to be a causal connection between this conduct that is alleged to be the bad faith duty and some injury to the plaintiffs. And the causal connection would have to be that this lobbying, so-called lobbying, we don't believe it's lobbying, but so-called lobbying led to the enactment of the legislation. If it didn't lead to the enactment of the legislation, that's the end of the inquiry. Now, plaintiff's counsel denied that, but why do we know it's true? look at the American Hospital Standard. The American Hospital Standard said the duty was breached is so recalcitrant in performing that duty that the injured party is forced to undertake certain action, bringing the lawsuit. Well, there'd be no injury. There would be no injury if Congress hadn't passed the legislation. So even under the American Hospital test, there has to be a causal link, and therefore to separate out their allegations of pre-litigation conduct on the agencies and to Congress would be improper. Make sure I'm clear on response to your question, Judge Bryson. That is, I agree with the court concerning the absence of a finding of bad faith conduct on the government pre-litigation. I agree that would need to be, if the court went there, would need to have
or a finding of no bad faith. I mean, the Judge Brueging just didn't find it necessary to address
that. Right,
issue,
and I would agree that would be inappropriate for this court to decide it, but I do think the question of whether, even if all their allegations were true, it would meet the American Hospital Standard is something that the court could address. And I think it's clear that the causation, the duty, it just doesn't meet it. And that's the only case which sets out any standard for pre-litigation conduct being a possible basis for liability, a bad faith liability. And finally, Your Honor, the argument I'd also like to raise that we did not prevail on below is that we believe that the fact that we paid the judgment in this case would be enough reason to simply deny the claim for lack of jurisdiction under the language of the statute. And that's outlined in our brief, but it's based upon 28 U.S.C. section 2517B, which says that payment of the judgment and of interest thereon shall be a full discharge to the United States of all claims and demands arising out of the matters involved in the case or controversy, unless the judgment is designated a partial judgment, in which event only the matters described therein shall be discharged. This was not designated as a partial judgment. We made the payment in the case. Their allegations are premised upon the underlying conduct. We believe that the payment was foreclosed by, I'm sorry, that their claim is foreclosed by the payment that we made. And we went ahead and we told them we were going to take this position. Nonetheless, they insisted upon payment. And we believe under the language of that statutory provision that that forecloses their claim. If the court has no other questions.
I do not.
Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Austin. Now, Mr. Yalowitz, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to begin by getting a chance to talk about the Postal Service hypothetical that everybody's been talking about.
All right.
Because I think that it's useful in sort of defining the difference between the D.C. Circuit standard, the Shimon standard, and the standard that the government is now arguing for. If the Postal Service engages in bad faith primary conduct, you know, intentional
they run you down in the street with a postal truck.
Right, and then whip you.
Right, all right.
You
know,
and then everything after that is done in good faith. Under the D.C. Circuit standard, it's very clear under the D.C. Circuit cases, like the Siegel case, and I would point to the Siegel case and the Copeland case, and some of the cases cited in those cases, that the D.C. Circuit would say the court has power to shift fees based on its traditional inherent equity powers. That's the D.C. Circuit standard. The Sixth Circuit would say in that phase two period, which is the administrative level, the bad faith is also compensable. And now the government is arguing that both phases, I guess, three and two under the Sixth Circuit test, which are in reverse chronological order, are not compensable. You cannot look at those. You must only look at phase one. And they're arguing that not based on any circuit that has adopted it. They're arguing it based on the inference they draw from a dissent in the Chambers case and on the theory that Chambers inherently or sub silentio overturned Vaughan, and I think they would agree if Vaughan is good law, their standard can't apply. And I would suspect everybody would agree it's not to this court to say we think Vaughan is overruled. This court would apply Vaughan. And if we are applying Vaughan under the Shemont test, and we're looking at phases 1 and 2, then we need a remand to Judge Brueging, because his test was phase 1 only. He never looked at the phase 2 conduct. He said, I'm not going to look at the phase 2 conduct. I'm only going to look at the Department of Justice conduct. And I agree that they were frivolous in some of their arguments. I agree. I sanctioned them hundreds of thousands of dollars for trial misconduct. But I can't say that everything they did in the defense of the litigation was in bad faith. So I'm not going to shift.
I'm not sure that he went quite that far, and maybe you can help me. I interpreted what he was saying is that in this case there isn't a Shemon phase 2.
Perhaps he's... I think he did say that. I agree that
I mean,
that
in so many
said.
Words, not...
I agree that that's what he said, and I would say two things about that. One is, of course there was, because Sentex wrote and warned the agencies that if they persisted in their course of conduct, they would be sued, and that it would be bad faith. So, of course, it wasn't an administrative claim in the way we were talking about with the Postal Service, but of course there was a phase two. There's always a period in which people anticipate litigation, but it hasn't yet arisen. And we know people can't start shredding documents and doing things that would enhance their ability to win a case that they anticipate just because the complaint hasn't been filed. And the other thing he said, the other reason there's not a phase two, or the other reason it doesn't make sense to adopt Shemont, is because in this case, there's not a clean sort of break between phases 3, 2, and 1. Phases 3 and 2 melded together to a significant degree, and that's why the cleaner, easier to apply D.C. Circuit standard is going to provide better guidance.
Okay.
Thank you,
Mr. Miller. Very well, Mr. Huffman, 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I agree with my colleague, and possibly even the government, that a remand would be appropriate here under whatever which of the two standards the court were to adopt, or even a hybrid or some third. If it's the American Hospital standard, I think it would be necessary because the trial court has not addressed the key issues, notwithstanding what my friend at the Department of Justice said. First of all, I never said there didn't have to be a causative link between the bad faith conduct and the unnecessary lawsuit. I think that that analysis is explicit in the American Hospital test. I believe I said and explained how that bad faith conduct contributed to the lawsuit and to the breach. But that is also an issue that the trial court has not examined because he felt that it was outside of his jurisdiction, if you will. So I do think that that's necessary. And Department of Justice counsel said it's that the agencies comply with the statute to make full and complete reports to Congress so long as they act in good faith. That presents the very question. We are saying they did not act in good faith when they made their representations to Congress, and that's an issue the trial court has not addressed. If it's the Shemin test, I think Mr. Galloway